My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Robert Dagoni. Bob, welcome back to KBOO. Welcome back to Portland.
Thanks very much. Thanks for having me, as always.
Sure. You've been here a couple times before with your previous books about poor David Sloan. We'll get into that in a little bit.
Okay. Yeah.
The title of the book this time is Bodily Harm. It's published by Touchstone. Let me introduce you a little bit to our listeners. You're born in Pocatello, Idaho,
Yep. Just
like Judy Garland.
Yeah. My father was going to pharmacy school up there, and before he left, he had six of us.
No kidding.
Yeah, six out of the ten.
He didn't spend all that much time at the pharmacy,
No.
Obviously. She was literally born in a trunk and backstage at a theater in Pocatello, Idaho.
Now, that I did not know.
Yeah, she was one of the Gum Sisters, G-U-M-M.
Oh,
okay.
Wow.
Okay, well, I'm already digressing. And
trivia,
finished.
Though. Yeah. That's interesting.
You were raised, though, in California. Where's Burlingame?
Burlingame is about 30 to 40 minutes south of San Francisco.
Okay.
When I grew up there, it was a tiny little middle-class suburb. Now you can't get in there. This, you know, like any place.
$6 million houses.
Yeah.
I know. Yeah. Okay. And you came from a family of 10 siblings, so you couldn't get a word in edgewise. You became a writer.
Yeah. You know, when you're the middle child in particular, and all your older brothers and sisters are compulsive overachievers, you learn how to succeed somehow.
Don't
and
you
mine
hate
was
people
writing.
Like that? I hate world beaters. You majored in communications and journalism and creative writing, and you worked as a reporter for the Stanford Daily, graduated Phi Beta Kappa. You're a smart guy, too. Worked briefly as a reporter at the Los Angeles Times, and then you went to UCLA Law School. Let's see, you practiced for a while in San Francisco, and then you moved to Seattle. Your books have been published in 18 foreign countries. In addition to writing novels, you teach the craft of writing and writing novels throughout the United States. And again, this is your fourth novel, the third in the David Sloan series, again titled Bodily Harm. Now, the first question I got to ask, man, is like people like to put their heroes, their protagonists, their main characters through a lot of changes in the books.
Yeah.
But this, I was horrified at what you did to this poor man.
Yeah.
Tell us about David Sloan and tell us what set up the situation for us.
Well, you know, this is the third book in the series, like you said, and Sloan has had some very high-profile cases, and in every single instance, his family is being threatened, and he's one of those guys that he can't say no. You know, where there's an injustice, he wants to step forward and handle it. You know, I never thought I'd write a series of books. I always thought I'd write standalone books, and so after I'd written The Jury Master, I really thought I was done with David Sloan, but it did so well, they wanted me to write more, and I came out with Wrongful Death last year, and that book did pretty well also, and so... You know, I wanted two things with this book, Ed. I really wanted it to move from the opening pages. And on my last draft, I ended up cutting 60 out of 118 pages just because I wanted it to just... I want the reader to start right in the middle of the story. And the second thing was I really wanted to shock the reader. I mean, I really want my readers to never know what I am capable of doing. I want them to always be on the edge of their seats that, you know, what's he going to do? And so... I do something in this book that's been very shocking to my readers. I get emails from all over the country. I know exactly where they are in the book when they write me, and they say, oh my God, I can't believe you just did that. But that's what I wanted.
Well, and parenthetically, you know, I mean, I'm not going to say what happens, mm-hmm. but among other things, David Sloan himself gets shot and nearly killed. And I know from having other writers tell me that if there's a cat in a series and you kill the cat, that you get 60 emails saying I'm never going to read your books again. So
yeah. No, you do. And again, it's the best emails that I'm getting are the ones where the people say to me, I can't believe you did that. I can't even read the rest of the book. Because I know they'll read the rest of the book. And then they'll email me later and they'll say, okay, I read the rest of the book and I know. And really, there was one woman in particular in Florida, and she just said, you know, these characters are so real to me that when you do these things to them, I take it personally. It personally hurts. And that's what I want. That's what every writer wants. You know what it's like.
To hurt people. Just joking.
You want your readers to really believe these characters are real people. And I think that if they're going to be real people, then you have to have no holds barred. They have to experience the same things in life that we all experience. You know, the joys of a birth, the sadness of a death, the little misdemeanor things we go through in life, children that don't behave, all those things that we all have to deal with in life, I think characters need to deal with. And I think that they... characters in particular need to be well-rounded, and to do that, you can't hide the skeletons in their closets. People have to know, you know, their bad side, their dark sides, their bedroom sides, to really believe that these are real characters.
There's a Yiddish expression, a mensch. This is somebody who, given a moral choice, will always make the right moral choice, will always do the good thing, will always be, when the chips are down, the kind of person you can rely on. And I'm not going to give this away, but at some point late in the book, David Sloan proves that he's a mensch. He does something which everybody probably groaned when they read it, and then they realize, of course, this was, in capital letters, the right thing to do.
Yeah, and you hit it right on the head. I mean, there was a lot of people, again, that was the second part in the book, where they would say to me, oh my God, why did you do that? Why did you do that? And then they stop and they think about it, and they do realize it's sort of that Solomon effect. You know, you do the right thing, that he was doing the right thing. And that's the hard part with David Sloan is, I set him up in the first two books as this guy that always does the right thing. He's a lawyer with a conscience. The problem with that is I don't want him to be superhuman. I don't want him to be Superman. You know, I want him to be the kind of guy that will do the right thing, but, you know, to have the same emotions we have, you know, flip somebody off in traffic when they cut them off. You know what I mean? A person that has the same set of emotions that all of us have. I don't want him to be this cardboard figure. But in the end, you know, he needs to be the person that rises above, that rises above all the other stuff and says, I got to do what's right. And he usually does.
You can have him lose a case every now and then. He's almost like a Perry Mason, you know.
Well,
in 70 years, he lost two cases.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. No, and again, that's the hard part. And I'm actually working on an idea now where, you know, for reasons we won't go into, you know, Sloan is extremely vulnerable in this next book I'm working on. And there's going to be some other shocking things that are going to happen because of that.
There's also another thing about your books. There's always some kind of a moral center. I've talked to other writer lawyers, lawyer writers, however you want to put it. D.W. Buffa is one that I've spoken with.
And I like his stuff.
He's a nice man also.
Yes.
And he, like you, is a lawyer with a conscience. And every one of his books, like yours, has a moral center. There's some issue that the book is about where it's not just who killed John. It's about something that we care about in our daily lives. It's a something that it's a right that he has to wrong that he has to right. Was that your idea with Sloan right from the beginning? I mean, he started out in the first book being like that.
Yeah, you know, being a writer yourself, that what you're looking for is you're looking for an issue that has a broad base to it, an issue that will capture readers' attention. So it's not just a situation like who killed John. Because there are a lot of those cases, unfortunately, out there. There's something bigger to it. There's something more to it. In this particular instance, you know, the mother and father of a young child want to know why their son is dead. And if it's not related to malpractice by a doctor, well, then they want to know what really happened to their son. And in this case, we're talking about toys and the toy industry, which is a fascinating, fascinating industry. But again, you know, I'm looking for, my agent likes to call it Bob Dagoni books. I'm looking for those books where there are potential injustices that arise out of real situations. You'll remember several summers ago, we had the summer of recalls, where we had the collapsible baby cribs, we had lead paint, we had toys that were cracking and breaking, and little parts that were coming apart that never should have, right? And all of that came about because of certain reasons that had happened, whether you want to say Democrat, Republican, certain things had led up to that point. Deregulation was one of them. Companies taking their products to be manufactured overseas was another one of them. Union stuff, all kinds of factors that led to what really amounts to a child dies. And the parents are left to grieve because of what happened that they had no control over. And so what I'm looking for is I'm looking for those big issues, but what I want to do is then take it down to a basic fundamental element. In Wrongful Death, the wife of a National Guardsman has four children at home now, her husband is dead, and she just wants to know what happened to him and why. Did his country do right by him? In this case, a mother and a father have lost their child, and they just want to find out why. What happened? And that's sort of what I look at, is try to keep it on an emotional level, but have raise a big enough issue that people can stop and say, wow, you know what? I never thought about that. The whole reason that this book came about is really pretty interesting, and I'll shorten it for you. But the bottom line is I'm reading Time Magazine one day, and they had an article on the 10 worst cars of all time. And I knew my car, my first car was on there, and it was. It was a Ford Pinto.
Oh, yeah.
The barbecue that seats four.
That's they could drive 300 miles and still have enough gasoline left for a major explosion.
Yeah, exactly. And the reason that came about, if you believe, you know, what you read, is that there was a conscious decision made by that company that they didn't want to fix that part because it would cost too much. And I took that idea of somebody actually doing a cost-benefit analysis. How much would we pay in lawsuits for death versus how much it would cost to actually recall the product and fix it? And I applied it to the toy industry.
The crib thing is still going on.
It is still going on.
There was just a court decision or yet another trial about a crib with a collapsing side that traps babies' heads in it. Yeah. My God.
Well, if you want to read something that'll blow your mind, go read about the history of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. I mean, this people like you and me and a lot of other people, you know, you walk into a store and you see a product on there. If you have kids, you see a product on the shelf and you think, well, it must be safe, right? It's in the United States. It's in a department store. It's up on a shelf. It must be safe. Somebody's looked at it. It might have a warning on it. It might have something. But you generally think it's safe. And then you read the history of the Consumer Product Safety Commission and you realize literally, there's one guy named Bob in a 1950s outdated lab that is supposed to be responsible for testing 15 to 20,000 toys coming through, you know, from the United States alone. It's impossible. It can't be done.
The Shrek glasses with the cadmium paint. This just happened.
Yeah.
There's no way of knowing. There's really no way of knowing.
No, there isn't. And that's the scary thing, especially for parents of children. It is very scary to think that, you know, you could do everything you can to keep your children safe. And I don't want to, that's really not what the book's about it, but you can do everything you want to keep your children safe, but you can't control everything. Mm-hmm. And that's why they call on a guy like David Sloan, you know, to step in and help him. The other thing I did differently in this book, Ed, is I really have a real honest to God antagonist in this book. I mean, I have a real bad guy in this book. My other books, you know, I couldn't personify the evil, if you will. And in this book, I was able to do that. And that also seems to make a difference to the reader because they can identify with somebody they really want to hate.
I'd like to remind our listeners that I'm speaking with Robert Dugoni. His last name is spelled D-U-G-O-N-I. The title of the book is Bodily Harm, published by Touchstone. Toy safety is part of this, but there's also predatory capitalism, industrial espionage, and what people will do to protect their investments. The book is all about those as well.
Yeah, you know, it's really fascinating. Again, you know, when I first came up with this idea and I was running it through with my agent and my editor, I could tell they were a little skeptical. And then I started to ask them, do you know that the toy industry makes 8 times as much money as the pet industry? And everybody thinks the pet industry is out of control at $3 billion a year. The toy industry, minus video games, makes anywhere from $25 to $30 billion a year. Now, if you come up with the next IT toy, okay, there are independent toy designers out there. A lot of it has gone in-house, but there are still a lot of independent toy designers out there. If you come up with the idea of Beanie Babies or Cabbage Patch Dolls or Tickle Me Elmos or the Purple Dinosaur or whatever his name was.
Barney,
the Purple Dinosaur.
It's imprisoned in my memory.
Yeah.
And I don't even have a kid.
Yeah. Those are potentially multi-billion dollar ideas. So you can imagine how valuable they are and what lengths people will go to steal the idea and get a knockoff out onto the product beforehand. And because of that, you can imagine how much secrecy and how much corporate disclosures are out there with people having to, you know, limit. These toys are put in vaults at night. They are literally worth more than pieces of art that you can put a price on. A Rembrandt, a Van Gogh, a Matisse. They're worth more than those. Much more. They're billion-dollar ideas. And whenever you have that, you have the potential for skullduggery. You have the potential for all that corporate malfeasance that you were talking about. And that's exactly the kind of thing that's ripe for the kind of thrillers that I write.
Well, it's more than just corporate malfeasance. It really is the essence of predatory capitalism, where I define predatory capitalism as having constantly to seek new markets, no matter how those markets are acquired, and to destroy all the competition in your wake.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, it's really interesting because if you read about the history of the toy industry, and it really applies to across the board, when Toys R Us came into being, all the mom-and-pop toy stores that had been all throughout the United States couldn't survive anymore. They could not compete with what Toys R Us was able to do, not only in terms of pricing, but in terms of shelf space and shelf exposure for toys. And so all those companies that had, like, you know, all those toy companies that had gone to those mom and pop stores and had relied on them for years and years, they abandoned them. And they went to Toys R Us. Well, then lo and behold, a bigger fish in the sea came along, Walmart, Sam's Club. And they nearly put Toys R Us out of business for the exact same reason. And you can take that model, if you will, that predatory capitalism model that you're talking about, and you can pretty much apply it across the board, including the book industry. I mean,
oh, yeah.
You know, I love
Crown Books, Barnes & Noble.
Yeah, the independent bookstores are fabulous because they're part of a community. They really are a community. They're like, my father was an independent pharmacist for 35 years. You go into the store and you say, you know, I like an Ed Goldberg book. Who else should I read? And they will tell you who you should read. They'll know it and they'll be able to explain it. I'm not knocking the Barnes & Nobles or the Borders of this world. I mean, I'm not at all. I mean, they have a function. They need to put that stuff out. But what we lose a little bit is we lose a little bit of that community that you're talking about when it becomes an issue of survival at all costs.
Well, Crown Books specifically, which was an Eastern chain started in the Virginia suburbs of Washington, they made a point of setting up a big discount bookstore across from an established, old-style, mom-and-pop, dusty-shelved, a guy who's 74 years old who knows every book in the place. They would set up right opposite or as close to that place as possible, even on the same side of the street, and those guys would be sorely stressed to stay in business.
Yeah, you've got mail. That was the whole premise of that
exactly.
Fabulous movie.
Yeah. Sort of.
You've
fabulous.
Got mail,
yeah.
But you know, and again, you know, Barnes and Noble and Borders are great outlets for writers. They're great sources of books. But they're dealing now with an even bigger fish in the sea, which is Amazon.com. And now Amazon's battling with Walmart and Sam's Club.
And Google.
And Google. And now, you know, now you're not only looking at situations where your book is getting discounted to $7. You know, they're talking about situations where, you know, people can get your book for $1 or maybe even download it for free.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, I know. It's anybody who thinks they know what's going to be happening in the publishing industry is either self-deluded or completely crazy anyway.
Yeah, I agree.
Let's talk a little bit about – I want to talk about Charles Jenkins. Charles Jenkins is the investigator for Dagoni, but he's a lot of other things. He's probably his closest friend.
I think
without a doubt his closest friend.
He is.
And he's also the kind of cop muscle end of the Dagoni thing. If Dagoni's the brain,
Sloan.
Then Charles Jenkins is the body. What?
Sloan.
Sloan. I'm sorry, what did I say?
Dagoni.
Oh.
A lot of people make that mistake.
Yeah, well, here you go. If Sloan is the head, then Jenkins is the body. And the bad guy, the epitomization of evil in this book that you have created, this Anthony Stanopoulos character, he's almost the polar opposite of Charles Jenkins, isn't he? He's the if Jenkins was all id and no superego, he would be Stanopoulos.
Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to tell a little bit more of because readers were asking for one, but I wanted to tell a little bit more of who is Charles Jenkins, where did he come from and how did he get there? And so it was a great opportunity for me to go back and tell his history. About how he came through the CIA. And he's also a guy with a conscience. Stanopoulos is just a bad guy. He's one of those guys that exists out there that just does not have feelings. I mean, he is a sociopath. And they exist. I mean, I've been sitting through a criminal trial for the last 3 months for the book I'm working on. And, you know, you see evil personified. And there are people out there that are like that. They see no good. It is just a matter of their own ego, their own narcissistic tendencies. And that's what Sloan and Jenkins are dealing with in this situation. They're dealing with a guy who has no conscience, who has no feelings whatsoever. He'll do anything he needs to succeed.
Of course, he's extremely efficient at what he does.
He is, which is always what you want for an antagonist. You always want your antagonist to even be better than your protagonist because you want the reader to never know what's going to happen.
Dr. Moriarty in Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah, or Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs.
Yep,
same
yep.
thing.
Do you want to talk about Metamorphosis? You want to tell us what the story is with that toy?
Yeah, I've been asked, you know, does Metamorphosis really exist? It's a toy, and it doesn't.
It's sort of a transformer.
Yeah, it is and it isn't. I created a toy. Obviously, I didn't want to create a toy that was, you know, there was such a likeness there that somebody would take offense to it. So what I did is I created a toy that really, to my knowledge, does not exist. It's a toy that runs on batteries, these tiny, very, very powerful magnets that you're finding in a lot of toys, toothbrushes, almost every household product now that are coming out of China. They're not natural man-made. They're all, they're not natural. They're all man-made, and they're extremely, extremely powerful. And so what I did is I created this toy, which, wow, if you could get one, it would be very cool, wouldn't it? It literally can go from one shape to another with just receiving an electrical pulse because the magnets then all interact with one another. And it's sort of like watching the movie, which, you know, that doesn't really exist. But these things can actually do this.
Morph in front of your very eyes.
They morph in front of your very eyes.
What's the problem with them?
The problem is that they cannot be manufactured at a cost that is at a price point that people will buy the toy at. And so since they can't be manufactured at that cost, the toy company decides to send the manufacturing overseas to China because it's cheaper to do it over there. The problem is the regulations over there are much more lax, and that's another issue in the book, is what American companies are dealing with now that we're on literally a worldwide global market, is they're dealing with other countries that do not have the same regulations in place, do not have to meet the same standards, which of course led to all the problems that you and I just previously discussed. And so the toy company sends this product overseas to China to have it manufactured, and of course the plastic that's supposed to be holding all these magnets and all these other pieces together does not meet ASTM standards, which means basically it's too thin and it cracks.
Let's discuss some of the characters in the book. Albert Payne, the aptly named Albert Payne,
yeah,
because he's in pain right from the first page of this book.
He is.
Tell us about when we first meet Albert Payne. That opening chapter is really a grabber.
It's fun. It was a very fun book to write. Albert Payne, when the book opens, he's in a room. In a hotel room in a province of China, where all the manufacturing takes place, and he's in the midst of a tour, and I don't want to say who he works for because that comes about later in the book, but he's laying in his bed when he wakes up and he's got this massive hangover, the kind that you can't even raise your head off the bed, and he realizes he's not alone. There's a woman sleeping to his right. And all he wants to do, right, his only goal in that scene is to get out of the room without waking this woman. But when he sits up to look for his clothes, there's a man sitting in the room across from the bed in a chair, very comfortably, very relaxed, who knows Payne's name, knows where he lives, knows what he does, and knows he shouldn't be in that bedroom. I wanted to create a career bureaucrat. I wanted to create the guy that's just happy to get up every morning and go to work in his cubicle and occasionally be promoted through the system. He's a federal employee. He's doing it because he gets great benefits, not necessarily paid that well, but he gets great benefits. He's taking care of his family, middle class guy, and he's just a career bureaucrat who suddenly, because of certain situations, has his life completely turned upside down.
But you also created Anne LaRoy.
Yeah. Anne LaRoy is sort of the opposite of Albert Payne. Anne LaRoy is supposed to be the young, energetic worker who comes to work with these bright ideas and these bright goals. And even though she's, you know, her friends are telling her she's crazy to go work for a federal agency, you know, like the Consumer Product Safety Commission, she has these ideals still. You know, she still believes in the American dream. She believes in Barack Obama's, you know, belief that one person can make a difference. And so she's sort of the anti-Albert Payne. And she gets involved in this situation, in this case, you know, about these defective toys. And she also finds herself way in over her head. She's a great character. I mean, she really came out well.
Mm-hmm. You also give us a politician, Senator Joe Wallace. Now, I know you can't say too much about him, but how was he involved with the toy, with the toy industry?
Well, it's hard not to, without revealing the end of the book, but basically there's a Senate inquiry into what is happening and why with regard to these defective toys, and they want to call certain people before the Senate inquiry to testify about what has happened, and so Joe Wallace is supposed to be one of the guys leading that Senate inquiry. And you know, obviously, he's not exactly who the reader begins to believe he is. It came about from that idea because there are so many situations out there where you have senators who are leading the Senate inquiry, and in reality, they're in the lobbyist's pocket. And it becomes not just hypocritical, but ridiculous that you have guys out there that are supposed to be protecting the American public's interest, and they're being you know, paid basically by these lobbyists, and it's crazy. Mm-hmm. And so that's what I really wanted to create with this Senator Joe Wallace. Again, you know, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to take an issue, okay, that the safety of a product or the safety of toys start at a very basic fundamental level. A mother and a father have lost their child, and run the reader all the way up through the very process that is the problem, which is, you know, who is overseeing who? I mean, who is really responsible for protecting the American public? And I think the shocking thing for readers is what you find out is there's really not a lot you can count on for protecting you.
Well, there's the old adage that comes from ancient Rome. It's who's watching the watchers.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's really what this book is about, is who's watching the watchers.
Yeah.
We have a minute and a half or so left. What are you working on?
David Sloan's coming back, and I'm working on a book where he will be involved in a criminal case, which, of course, he's never done, and neither have I. And again, it's an opportunity for me to sort of give the reader something new, something fresh. I'm billing it, I'm talking about it as a cross between Presumed Innocent and Basic Instinct. And when the book opens, Sloan is going to be in an extremely vulnerable, emotionally vulnerable position in his life, point in his life. And a woman's going to come into his life, and she's going to say, basically, I want to hire you because I want to go after a Russian drug dealer who overdosed my daughter, and she died. Sloan gets involved in this situation, and before he can get going, the drug dealer is murdered. And all facts and all evidence seem to lead to this one particular woman. Mm-hmm. And the question for the reader is, did she do it, or is she being set up? And that's the exact same question for David Sloan.
It's not going to be Sharon Stone, is it?
If they make a movie, they could bring her back. I think she's too old now.
No, she could play somebody's mother. I mean, she certainly could. Before we close, had any nibbles from the movie community to do your books?
Nibbles. Yeah. Nibbles. Yeah, no nibbles. And, you know, there might be some exciting news in the next couple of weeks.
I certainly hope so. You'll let us know?
Yeah, I absolutely will let you know. It would be really neat, but nothing that I can really, you know how it is.
I know
nothing
you can really report. Don't say anything. First of all, it'll put a hex on things. Yeah. So, yeah.
And the other thing is just, you know, things can move so slowly that, you know, it's like waiting for someone's baby. You know, you never tell anybody that you're pregnant until it's obvious, because then you just keep getting the same question over and over and over.
You always say that the pitcher on the other team is pitching a no-hitter, but you never say it if the pitcher on your team is pitching a no-hitter.
True.
It's always good to talk to you.
You
Robert
too.
Dagoni. If you haven't read this guy's books, give me the title of the first two David Sloan books again.
The Jury Master and Wrongful Death.
Wrongful Death. You were here just last year for Wrongful Death.
Correct.
This one is entitled Bodily Harm. It's published by Touchstone. Again, Robert's last name is spelled Dugoni. Thanks for coming.
Thanks. Can I give my website real quick?
Absolutely.
It's www.robertdagoni.com, and you can reach me at bob@robertdagoni.com. I answer all my own emails. So
I know
to
he
hear
does.
From you.
He answers mine. So. Yeah. Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Ed.